Welcome back to this third portion of today's seminar entitled Turning Anxious Anticipation into Possibility Thinking. We're going to start with continuing with some different types of therapy approaches that may be used with people with anxiety. One type of therapy that can be particularly helpful is art therapy. The use of metaphor tends to work really well with people with anxiety. Sometimes it can be difficult for them to talk directly about those waves of stress that come in, especially when they're feeling panic, when their heart's racing, they're having the butterflies in the stomach, they're feeling shaky or nervous. Art provides another alternative outlet for them. This includes things like drawings. I've had clients even currently who use the metaphor in the drawings to draw what they think anxiety or depression looks like. If it was a character, for example, what attributes might it have? What might it look like? For some people, they've said it might be small, but yet intimidating, with a loud, ominous voice, focusing on those automatic negative thoughts. With other people that have had a lot of avoidance and escape tendencies, they have highlighted how anxiety might be like a character with tape over its mouth that has something to say, but is afraid about the consequences, the what ifs, the maybes, the what next. So drawing, art, painting, use of clay, sculpting, or modeling can be variations that can be helpful. There's a number of books out there, for example, that talk about how when you're using, say, finger paints, sometimes just the action of being able to throw the paint on the paper, you know, when you're feeling that stress, that anger, that anxiety, especially if there's issues of abuse or trauma, PTSD-like stuff, that sometimes it helps. And over the course of therapy, you may see a real difference in the nature of the paints being splattered over the page versus more smooth strokes, which is interesting to watch. That sensory element, especially for people with trauma-based anxiety, can really be helpful when we're using like clay and sculpting and painting. Somehow that really brings a lot of healing to the clients. So art therapy can be one of many other types of therapy that can be particularly beneficial for those with anxiety. Another thing that we don't want to minimize is the importance of the physiological or holistic approach to dealing with anxiety. For example, there's a great deal of literature that suggests that there's benefits to physical exercise, just getting those endorphins going. I've had clients that when they say that they're anxious, they feel just revved up. They feel that burst of energy. But if they can distract themselves with something else, like going to a gym, walking, or some type of physical movement, that can also, but in a positive way, create some endorphins. For one, physical exercise lessens avoidance, which we know can be toxic for many of our clients with anxiety. It reduces that sense of hyperarousal and hypervigilance that many of our clients have. Physical exercise also has been shown through the literature to improve sleep quality and to reduce the overall frequency and intensity of hazardous alcohol use. Exercise can train the body to have reduced physiological reactivity to stimuli. That alone could be a huge benefit to many of our anxious clients. Remember, cues become threatening for many of our anxious clients. So what would it be like if things could be less threatening and their body could learn appropriately to have an increased heart rate with the exercise and then to decrease and be able to perceive those cues more accurately? So especially if you're pairing things like physical exercise and leisure time with the cognitive, behavioral, or other approaches that we've discussed. So physical exercise actually has been shown to have similar results to exposure interventions. One of the areas I wanted to make sure also in today's seminar to highlight is the topic of shame. I have seminars I've taught separately on this topic, but I would say that shame is often linked to many of our clients that have anxiety. Shame basically is a subjective emotion. It's the sense that I'm inadequate, I'm not enough. As a person, I've fallen short. Basically, shame is a narrow-focused, automatic emotional reaction. Many of our clients with anxiety have this habitual reaction where perhaps they're self-critical, or maybe they grew up in a family system that they felt was critical. As a result, shame may even have taken them to the point of feeling paralyzed or immobilized. On the other hand, shame also could lead someone to this frantic, desperate attempt to work harder, do more, be enough, be approved of. Shame is something that happens when a client finds it difficult to separate out behavior from personhood. So there's a difference between a client who says, gosh, I wish I would have done things differently, and perhaps has some regrets in life. That person, you know, we can actually work with and say, okay, what would you like to have done? We can train behaviors. We can look at alternative new behaviors. Versus someone who personalizes it and says, gosh, I'm just a failure. Because that second person truly has an inner perception of inadequacy. They believe that they're inherently flawed and imperfect. There's a premise that it's possible or impossible, I'm sorry, that it's impossible for someone to love them because they're defective. And that can be a difficult core schema to break. We see that a lot with clients, particularly with obsessive compulsive disorder patterns, where they're trying to undo some of that sense of shame. They may think they're less than who they should be, or they don't measure up to others. There's this sense of being really self-conscious, and there's this increased self-awareness or hyper-awareness. There's negative, global, stable, erroneous assumptions. So there's a lot of fear surrounding shame. Fear of disrepute, considering these erroneous assumptions that others may not like me, that it's my job to keep others happy at all times. Those if-then statements, those cognitive errors of if only I was good, strong, right, or perfect enough, then life would go better. The challenge with shame is actually it necessitates a cover-up, meaning that because someone feels so embarrassed because of what they perceive as their flaws, they tend to keep it secret. So one of the very things that we want to do to help our clients who battle the concept of shame is to help them verbalize the concerns, the fears, the shame. The point is, once it's verbalized, it can actually be dealt with. It can be confronted. We can discuss and work through, in the course of therapy, this whole concept of fear of vulnerability. Many of our clients who battle shame issues also will talk about a history of distrust. They may talk about betrayals, people talking behind their back, perceptions that they're going to be let down again. There's this real sense of disappointment in themselves and an unstable self-identity. Shame also has been shown to be negatively correlated with self-compassion. One of the things to this end that I've ended up working with many of my clients who battle shame on is the idea of giving oneself mercy. Just because we feel a wave of anxiety, just because our body feels nervous and we tend to be harsh with ourselves sometimes, doesn't mean that it's actually the truth. So to be able to look at, do I give myself the same degree of mercy and compassion as I might give a friend or someone else out there? Oftentimes we find with people with anxiety that they tend to be more understanding, merciful, and kind to others who have flaws, mistakes, shortcomings, or just dealing with regular life than they are to themselves. A lot of times I'll even ask my client, if you could give yourself the same mercy and compassion that you give others, how do you think life might be different? And then look at, well, why judge yourself in a much more harsh manner than you do other people? A metaphor I use to talk about and address some of these issues is that of this question, what are you eating? Basically, what are you chewing on? What are you hyper-focusing on? Is it others' opinions? Because that might lead to frantic, desperate, over-trying, overdoing, and having, again, these all-or-nothing thoughts of everyone must like me, everyone must agree with me or support me. So this constant trying. It can lead to mental preoccupation and hyper-focus on every move I make. There can be a struggle internally between what would personally bring me hope and take me closer to the dreams that I would want in life versus what other people might want of me, or I guess that other people want of me. In the article I cite by Ruiz, he talks about if you eat all of the emotional garbage, it becomes your emotional garbage. But if you do not take it personally, you are immune, even in the middle of hell. I think one of the things that has benefited many of my clients is this idea that it's not personal. It may feel personal. Anxiety, when it comes in those waves, especially that physiological panic, it feels personal. It feels like all eyes are on me. They know, they can tell my uneasiness. But the fact is, just because it feels personal, really, is it personal? Do that many people out there genuinely think about me to that level where they're deeply, deeply concerned about things? Another way we can look at things is this idea of before we can make deep changes in our own lives, we have to look into our diet, our emotional diet, our way of consuming. We have to live in such a way that we stop consuming the things that poison and intoxicate us. Then we will have the strength to allow the best in us to arise. We will no longer be victims of anger or frustration. Remember that saying about insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results? We all, to some degree, when anxiety rules, focus on that helplessness, that poison. We allow that poison to take over. So looking at, do I want to be intoxicated with this poison? Is there any other way I can choose a different path? One of the freeing things my clients say is helpful to them is when I do talk in terms of you have choices. Because the fact is even if they have one or two choices, that's something that they can choose. Now, shameful beliefs also can be addressed through cognitive behavioral therapy, which we know across the board is one of the most highly cited therapies for anxiety and depression. Some of the beliefs that people have with shame are things like, I feel inferior. In cooperative situations, I'm constantly comparing myself. I'm lesser than or not as good as so-and-so. I doubt myself. I feel insecure. I don't feel so good about myself. Many people who have shameful belief report this sense of embarrassment, particularly in public or social situations. They may also report feeling lonely or left out. They imagine that because they feel critical of themselves, that others feel that of them. They also imagine that people are greatly disappointed in them. I think of the other day, a teenager I was working with, whose parents were trying to motivate him about focusing and following through on some task for school. And so even when they would offer suggestions or just check in with him about how he was doing on things, he would hear a neutral comment or just a neutral informational question as a personal comment. When they said, oh, how are you doing on your homework? Where are you at with this? Just to check in, keep monitoring, he would think, oh, well, they want to catch me not doing the right thing. I'm disappointing them. They're not happy in me. There's this idea among people who have shameful beliefs that they don't feel like they could handle if they were rejected. So fear of rejection is a big one too that our clients can deal with. They also may not like when they think others see their faults. And again, there's this erroneous perception that if I feel like I'm on the spot, if I feel socially awkward or inadequate, I think other people can tell that about me. They also have the sense of I feel humiliated, I feel guilty, I'm hopelessly flawed, I didn't measure up, I'm never going to be accepted, wanted, or needed just as I am. I'm a failure, I'm a mistake. Now you hear that I, it's personal to the anxious person, these shameful beliefs. Not I have done a behavior I wish I could change, but I personally am flawed. I'm alone. I'll never be loved and accepted as I am. It's only okay if I think or do certain things. Only perfect relationships matter. And the fact is, we know there is no perfect, good, right, strong person who is liked unconditionally by everyone. So it's important that we teach our clients what I call these cognitive debating skills, because to them, they make these erroneous assumptions. The first one off the bat that I tend to use with clients is this a fact? Because I tell my clients feelings lie. Feelings seem awfully strong, especially when we're going through the waves of anxiety. It feels like a fact. It feels like a guarantee that I'm flawed, I failed, I've fallen short, everybody knows it, I'm always going to be less than. But is it a true fact? Is it absolutely across the board a guarantee I'm just always 100% of the time wrong, there's nothing good or right about me? No, it's not a fact. Even if we can find 1 to 3 exceptions, then definitely it's not a fact. Another cognitive debating question we can encourage our clients to think of is, according to who? Who says this? Even if I found an example of someone who thought in an unpleasant way about me, why is what that particular person is saying so important? Why does that have to be the truth? You know, and I'll even joke about that. Clients like when we use a sense of humor. When I say, wow, so that person in your school is a relationship expert. They just have had so much life experience from junior high or high school or even as a young adult that they are the one everyone goes to. They know what should happen. Well, no. And then that gets a laugh out of my clients. they can also learn. Is there any other way of thinking about this? Is this thought, is this really helpful and beneficial? Because if it's not life building, if it's not emotionally healthy, encouraging, or promoting healing, how can I continue to tell myself this? Is there really anything that I'm gaining by blaming myself, by fault finding, by being hard on myself? Then on a deeper level, one of the things we can definitely explore with our clients is this idea of what might they actually be reacting to? Because the first initial thing may seem like it, but a lot of times what they're reacting to represents something else. Then the idea of, am I getting anything out of proportion? What harm has actually been done? So, okay, I made a mistake. What does that mean? It means I'm human, just like other people. It doesn't mean I'm so flawed and awful and different. I love using solution-focused and strengths-based approaches along with this. So I like the idea of empowering a client to realize that, as I'll say, I imagine that by this point in time, at some time, you did face change. Even manage change that you didn't expect, whether it was a move, whether it was a change of school or job, whether a relationship took a turn in a different way than you thought. Is it possible that you might be underestimating your ability to cope? And that's a real different way of thinking for many of our clients. Is it possible that instead of going to that automatic negative thought and pressuring place, that you actually have skills that maybe you've overlooked to be able to manage things? Is it possible that just because you feel bad, you're assuming and thinking this situation is bad? Are things really totally black or white? Are they as clear-cut as I'm making them? Is it really all or nothing? So maybe some of the best thing we can do is helping our clients live in those gray areas, in those in-betweens where much of life is. The idea being maybe there is more than one solution to a problem. So one of the things that we can look at with a client, especially again going back to the theme of shame, is helping address some of the questions I'm going to go over with you now. Things like filling in the blank to, I want others to think, perceive, or feel certain things about me. What is it that I expect or want them to think of me? For example, lately I've had some people that are particularly self-conscious in social situations. And they'll talk to me about what they believe other people are judging or criticizing them about. And so I'll ask them, so what is it you want other people to believe about you? And that there's some part of that they can work towards. Not that we're ultimately responsible or we can change someone's worldview totally, but looking at, are my behaviors actually demonstrating the things that I'm saying are important to me? What are my expectations? How realistic are they? If they're not life-giving, as we said before with these cognitive distortions, but they're death-producing, I feel discouraged, I feel hopeless, how can I continue to tell myself them? Is my identity truly focused on what I want or what I think others want for me? What could be the worst thing if someone perceives me differently than I'd like to be perceived? What can I control about what people think, or what can I control about the environment? Sometimes it's realistic to look with our clients at what I call their social support or their connection network. there is something in the literature called the law of thirds. I was just working with my clients on this the other night, and how oftentimes with anxiety, we tend to focus on this third of people in our life who maybe never will just click with us for whatever the reason, that we want everyone, this imaginary everyone, to just like and approve of us, rather than focusing on the two-thirds that we could realistically be focusing on. The one-third being those who love and support us almost across the board. Parents, close friends, family, for some people maybe their faith, their community. Or the second third we could look at are those neutral people that are around us. Maybe they're not the closest, dearest friends, but they're definitely not against us. So it's helpful for us to look with our clients at who really could they say gives them empathy and support. Who, on the other hand, might keep the shame going? Am I distracting myself with that one-third that is not going to be a support, rather than looking at the two-thirds, those who are already supports or those who can be neutral and not condemning? Then we can look at how empathy could be built. Remember, like I said, that a lot of the healing for the anxious person is dealing with the concept of vulnerability, of open-endedness, of shame, and their worries. So the healing boils down to helping give our clients a voice. So helping them get beyond the fear of sharing with another, giving them courage to speak. Many of our clients, you know, share with me or with other counselors that oftentimes they don't feel like they have the ability to, quote, rock the boat in certain areas of their life. And so we provide a really useful service by the therapy we do of providing a forum where they can speak and helping them realize that they can have courage to speak, who they can speak to, who might be reasonable people to give their heart to. Brené Brown has some wonderful literature out there about the concept of shame, about what she calls wholehearted living. I love the way she puts this. She says, we can simultaneously be imperfect people and have our failures, just because we do, because we're human, but yet still worthy of love. So it's not one or the other. It's not because I make mistakes, I'm unworthy. It's in spite of my mistakes, I'm worthy of love. We can start to help our clients to see vulnerability as something that is necessary and desirable if they want genuine intimacy in their relationships. Excuse me. We can acknowledge their fears, but also let them know that sometimes it's taken moving past that fear to be able to build the support system, to get to the level of trust that they're hoping for. So empowering them to have the courage to risk failure and heartbreak, and eventually helping them to be willing to feel authentically what they feel in the here and now. Learning to be comfortable, another way of saying this is learning to be comfortable with not being blank enough, perfect enough, tall enough, short enough, talented enough in a certain area. All of us have those unspoken messages that we wish we would measure up more. Another area of vulnerability that oftentimes we need to address with our clients is learning to deal with the fear of the unknown. Brené Brown defines this as, we wake up every day loving someone who may or may not love us back, whose safety we can't ensure, who may stay in our lives or may leave without a moment's notice, who may be loyal to the day I die or betray us tomorrow. That's vulnerability. Love is uncertain. It's incredibly risky. And loving someone leaves you emotionally exposed. Yes, it's scary. And yes, we're open to being hurt. But can you imagine your life without being loving or having been loved? She talks also about vulnerability as being capable of being wounded, open to attack or damage. And I know when we say it that way, you're probably thinking, why would a client want that? I always use that question, you know, is it better to have loved and lost or never to love at all? And I think many of our clients and ourselves would say, you know, to know love, to have some of that vulnerability is better, even in spite of some of the ups and downs, than to not know it and feel on the outside. A lot of times I'll highlight with my clients that even if they have a few close friends in their life, that they did take a risk at some point to allow those people in. And if they did that before, they might be able to do that again. So vulnerability then becomes a good thing. Not to say it's not scary, not to say we don't have to ride some waves of anxiety, but it can be a good thing. Another author says that many of us prefer practices that will not cause us discomfort. Yet, at the same time, we want to be healed. But it doesn't work that way. A warrior accepts that we can never know what will happen to us next. We can try to control the uncontrollable by looking for security and predictability, always hoping to be comfortable and safe. But the truth is we can never avoid uncertainty. This not knowing is part of the adventure. And it's also what makes us afraid. This one who wants something to hold on to can finally learn to grow up. So how does vulnerability play out, and how can we support that with our clients? One way it might play out is us helping a client be accountable for things. There may be areas they want to try to do, but again, they're fearful. Maybe they've been hurt before. Maybe there's shame. Maybe they have that hyper-focus on those worrying cognitions that we talked about at the beginning of today's seminars, of the idea of, I'm convinced that because I feel like people are judging me, that they are. So we might need to hold them accountable, give them little like homework assignments to practice certain things that they may be avoiding. Another example of another type of vulnerability might be a client asking for forgiveness. The idea of making amends, of I can redo something. I had a girl the other day who said she had a lot of regrets in her life. She wishes she would have done things a certain way in many situations in her life, and they didn't turn out that way. One thing I tell my clients in that situation oftentimes is everything is modifiable. It's not too late. Maybe we do have a discovery later where we say, wow, knowing what I know, I wish I would have done A, B, and C. So asking for forgiveness or communicating the desire for forgiveness. Another type of vulnerability is having faith. The idea to believe in a higher power or something beyond ourselves, that takes vulnerability. Vulnerability, though, also buffers against shame. What we do through these exercises with our clients is helping them to rehearse and find the positive, to look at the big picture, to see events in context, to build social networking and connection, because that builds evidence for our clients that the things they fear or dread or the shame-based messages aren't necessarily as bad as they thought. Then at that point, our clients have a better sense of belonging and identity and realism about owning their part. They can start practicing mercy towards themselves. They can look that they're a lot more than just their imperfections. One thing I think that's significant for us also to look at with our anxious clients is the concept of resiliency. You might remember Martin Seligman in your graduate courses talking about learned helplessness, that if you paired the bell ringing or a sharp sound with giving a food or some type of stimulus with an animal, they became fearful sometimes. But recently, Martin Seligman's done a lot of research about learned optimism. And he studied this concept of who bounces back, even when there's tough events in life, even when there's things, it could even be a trauma or an event that's experienced as traumatic. The idea is the people who do bounce back, who are resilient, tend to see setbacks as only temporary and changeable. That they realize that, yeah, things might not be going the way I want, but this is one aspect of the narrative of my life. Eventually, over time, things will change again. Eventually, I will have a little more control in shaping the narrative. Those who bounce back are also people who keep persisting at tasks. They're people who are creative, who have new and different ideas, who look beyond the initial opposition, who know how to separate the heat of the moment and that stress from life decisions. So in other words, they can tell themselves, feelings lie. This wave of anxiety, this anxious anticipation, really might be an opportunity for a possibility I haven't considered in a positive way. Those who bounce back are also those who apply the cognitive behavioral strategies. They identify their toxic belief systems for what they are, and they look at whether or not truly their behaviors are helpful. There's literature on hope theory. When we talk about hope, it's not just the ability to daydream about a better future, but it's actually the ability to have pathways or steps or action steps towards getting there. So there's two components, really, to the definition of hope. And it's important that we make sure our clients have both. So not just the ability to dream and be future-oriented, which we call agency, but also pathways, behavioral plans of implementing goals. So agency is the belief that goals can be met, and pathways is the behavioral plan to do that. One way we can help them get to this is we can help them, using that strengths-based, solution-focused approach, look at what their past successes have been. We can help them reconceptualize their goals. I always like to use the idea of a camera check. What would an imaginary video camera actually see? What would it envision? We can provide accountability. We can use cognitive behavioral principles. So we can identify those negative thoughts and help a client actually concretely record more helpful ways of thinking and solutions. Help them to look at rules for living and whether they're helpful or not, what they're doing. Help them look at alternative explanations for the negative automatic thoughts. On a behavioral level, we can actually, through homework assignments or through role-play practices in our counseling, actually conduct behavioral experiments to increase the believability of alternative thoughts. Just because I feel, again, the wave of anxiety doesn't mean that my feelings are accurate, that they're telling me the whole truth. So I actually go through these possible thought errors. Things like awfulizing, catastrophizing, or discounting the positive. And as I go through them, clients will frequently say, yeah, that's me. I do that. So we'll start by teaching foundations of some of these thought errors and then customizing counseling to identifying their errors and teaching some cognitive debating skills. So, for example, we might help them increase awareness of when they tend to jump to the worst conclusions, where they're predicting only negative outcomes for the future, where they're awfulizing, catastrophizing, and seeing the worst. If such and such happens, if that thing I'm worrying about happens, my life's going to be over. I won't be able to handle it. Then my comment might be back to them, it may feel over, but it sounds like at this point in your life, you have dealt with, whether willingly or unwillingly, you have dealt with some changes. Let's talk about how you've managed. What skills have you used before? Are any of those skills you might be able to use again? Another type of thought error someone might have is disqualifying or discounting. Maybe they're minimizing the positive and magnifying the negative. All or nothing thinking is another one we might want to identify with clients. Or low frustration tolerance. We also see either self-deprecating or other-deprecating derogatory beliefs. One I see often with my clients is the one of emotional reasoning. People kind of looking backwards and thinking, oh, I remember when I went through this anxious thing before, such and such factors were going on, and I just feel like that's happening again. I just intuitively have this fear that here we go again. And so then people reason backwards instead of testing out their assumptions. So once we've identified the thought errors, we definitely want to teach our clients how to test those out and see that they are truly errors, that we're overgeneralizing from very limited experience instead of taking each experience within context. Some of our clients also do the thought error of labeling or stereotyping things. Oh, my life's always like this. People always think this of me. Everyone will have bad opinions about me. No one will just approve of me. I'll never be able to trust such and such. They may try and predict or do mind reading. They may overgeneralize things based on limited information. We talked about a little bit ago, they may personalize things. I see that a lot with couples. Sometimes one person will read into the other's behavior. Oh, my spouse is quiet. Must be something going on. Oh, they're hiding something from me. Something's on my partner's mind. And while that might be sometimes the case, we don't want to necessarily assume that. That's something where it might be useful for them to actually check in with their spouse. Is that possible? Maybe they could mention, oh, I'm seeing that you're kind of on the quiet side. When I see someone quiet, it makes me think that maybe there's something going on, but I don't want to assume that. Is it possible that something's going on? And again, ask it as a question rather than an assumption. One of the techniques I also teach my clients that people find a bit funny because they remember it because of the funny wording, I call watch where you put your butts. So I talk with clients about if we're going to jump to those automatic, negative, unpleasant things, then let's at least tell ourselves the whole truth. That it's possible to admit our unpleasant feelings, our concerns, our worries, the irrational thoughts, or any questions we might have or assumptions. But at least let's put them in context. So if a client says, I just feel like this thing's going to turn out so bad. I just know it's going to mess up. So I won't say, okay, I won't debate the feeling and the accuracy of it. I say, okay, you're allowed to feel afraid of that or concerned or have that automatic thought. But let's tell ourselves the whole truth. Let's put this in context. So then we add the word but, and at the end of the statement, a positive self-statement, a rational, realistic statement that is strengths-based. So, for example, I feel like things might not turn out the best. I'm worried that I might make a mistake, but at least I can try. I'll never know if I don't try. That person, after the word but, is focusing on affirming their abilities to be vulnerable and things possibly helping them find an exception to what they fear. The errors we tend to make are we tend to just tell ourselves that first part, the unpleasant feelings, the worries, the automatic thought. Or we tend to tell ourselves the statement in reverse. Well, yeah, I guess I could try things out. Maybe it'll be okay, but I just tend to mess things up and I'll probably mess this up too. So what I help clients do, again, is tell themselves the whole story and narrative. And then we take what's after the word but, that rational, realistic, positive self-statement, that strengths-based, and we convert those almost to, you know, to another sheet of paper to where they're personalized statements and affirmations that that client can use. I'll actually read to them the stuff on the left side of the equation, the unpleasant automatic thoughts, and say, how do you feel if this is all you tell yourself? I think I'm going to mess up again. People are watching me. I'm not sure I'll do very good. Things never work out for me. I can't keep everybody happy. I don't know how to do things good, right, and perfect. And then a client will say, wow, that's stressful and overwhelming. And we'll talk about how that does keep that anxiety going. Versus, I'll read the stuff after the word but I can try, but I might find out some information that some people actually support me more than I thought they did. But I have made it through some changes and challenges in my life thus far, and I've actually done pretty well with some of them. But things are always modifiable, and if I don't like the way things happen, I could do it a different way. So then I'll ask the client, how do you think you'd feel if you focused on the things after the word but? And the client will say, wow, you know, I'd feel a sense of relief. I'd feel more optimism. One of the things that the literature also talks about is they call it develop a normalization card. So maybe like an index card, but with those rational, realistic affirmations, with reminders of how you can or you have already managed things and cope. Reminders and evidence of safety and security. Cues for relaxation. Things about remembering the techniques that have been learned over the course of therapy. So some of the effective interventions that clients have seen are us providing education, realistic education about anxiety disorders. The first thing I tend to say to my clients is it's not that you're necessarily never feel anxious, but instead you'll learn to ride the wave of anxiety. And instead of thinking, oh man, here we go, this is dreadful, anxiety's coming, maybe thinking, ah, oh, it's just anxiety again. And using that word just really puts it in context. So providing psychoeducation about anxiety disorders is one of the interventions, especially initially, I think that can be helpful to our clients to put their anxiety in context. Another one that I have clients do is write a goodbye letter to anxiety. Is this personified anxiety, this character, really beneficial? Do I really want to have a relationship with him or her? Because they tell me part-truths. They tell me twisted lies and distortions, and it's worse than it is. Another type of intervention we might do with clients is applying some behavioral experiments, some homework, to see that if they are imperfect, the whole world doesn't fall apart, and that they can observe the consequences of being imperfect and plan for the what-ifs. Look at what the coping skills are they have, or if there's some social skill development that needs to happen, we can help support that. We can role model that. We can practice that in session. I also like to have my clients use scaling. Assign a percentage to their automatic thought from 0 to 100. How likely is it that this thing is actually going to happen? And then test their assumptions and discover reality. So in the last portion of this seminar, I'd like us to kind of put things together and do a couple case conceptualizations here of possible clients with anxiety. So you may want to jot down some things of what you think might be some approaches to dealing with these clients. So case number one, a 30-year-old man reports feelings of anger, rage, and unforgiveness after being the victim of a drunk driving accident. He says, according to the medical records, he nearly died. And he produces copies of the records, so that's true. He said he doesn't understand why, quote, little things get to him very easily, unquote. He's becoming easily irritated by people around him, especially ones that remind him of what he thinks are attitudes or personality traits of the drunk driver. There's several anxiety triggers for him, such as evening times, like the time when the accident happened, and wet, rainy weather, storms, or water, like in the shower, which remind him of the night of the accident. He states, sometimes when I get in the shower and the water hits me, I start crying and getting angry again. He also says he can't hear Celine Dion songs because that was what was playing when he left the bar with his friends and got hit by a drunk driver. He has to go to court since he's prosecuting the drunk driver, and he fears seeing that guy actually in person. He's been told by his lawyer that the drunk driver has a history of multiple drunk driving offenses before and is even in a wheelchair but continues to drink, which is information his lawyer provided him. His lawyer also tells him that the man likely, quote, doesn't have remorse, unquote, and, quote, likely won't apologize, unquote. The client's lawyer is uncertain how much he can handle or how much he will remain composed emotionally in spite of symptoms because they may have a jury trial. What's your initial thoughts when you hear about this case? So the first thing that comes to my mind is trauma. Something happened that this client experiences trauma. He's having memories, he's having flashbacks, possible PTSD. His body sounds like it's having some pretty strong physiological reactions. Even things like rain or water or the shower, certain songs, certain elements that are similar to what he experienced somatically the night that he was hit by a drunk driver, are replaying in his mind as if it's happening in the here and now. So I think helping identify what some of the somatic sensations are is important. I find for many of my clients, if they are having things they're experiencing as trauma or having those somatic sensations, they may need to physically be de-escalated through either things like systematic desensitization, physical relaxation, or something that physically calms them down before they actually can get into more of the cognitive behavioral. Because keep in mind, if your body's revved up and you're the fight, flight, freeze reaction, you're ready for, you know, whatever it feels like is going to happen next, it's really hard to just tell yourself to talk yourself out of it. So acknowledging the physical sensations, I think, needs to be the first step. And then physically de-escalating. When I worked with this client in particular, we also talked about how to allow himself, if he was going to go to the jury trial and be part of it, to take breaks and not be pressured on the spot to answer things quickly, not feel that, you know, intensity of the wave of anxiety, to even ask for time if need be. And we practiced how to do that in session. I need a minute. This is overwhelming for me. I'm having some thoughts and memories right now, and I need to regroup. I would like some time to do that. So that he allowed himself the freedom to do that, that he didn't initially have when the incident happened. We also ended up using a lot of narrative therapy, which I think can be particularly helpful for someone who is experiencing what feels to them as a traumatic reaction. Because narrative therapy reminds them, yes, something happened to you, and it might have felt truly awful. You might still have ongoing memories of it. But if you are the author of your story, there is the here and now, and there are chapters of your life yet to be written. You get to decide the narrative from here. It's not just imposed on you because of something that happened. And so that was particularly meaningful for this gentleman, as well as other people that I've dealt with. I've had combat war veterans. I've had people that experienced harassment and assault, and abuse situations that, you know, went through very real traumatic things. And for them, the idea of giving a voice to the trauma in small doses, allowing themselves to face and feel the vulnerability with the help of the techniques we provide in counseling, and then looking at the next chapter of the narrative was very helpful to them. Let's look at case number two now. A single man in his mid-30s wants to meet someone and is coming in for anxiety. Though he's rather pleasant, attractive, and friendly, he believes that in social situations, people constantly analyze him and do not think well of him. When he sees others, whether they're people he already knows or new people at happy hours or parties, he's convinced they're talking and laughing has to be about him. He believes he's attractive and is a good catch, but that no one will ever find that out because they can see how socially inept he is. On the MMPI-2, the test, he is scored in the clinical range for the anxiety scale and in the low clinical range for paranoid delusional thoughts. So keep in mind, many of our clients, when they have anxiety disorders and anxious anticipation, they believe that cognitive belief that worries are helpful, that the more I worry, the more it will benefit me, it will prepare me for potential situations, and that there's some truth. So one of the key things is acknowledging and validating as much as we can. Again, validating, not necessarily agreeing with his idea that social situations can be tense. But then I think for him, overall, He would be a great candidate for a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy to look at the automatic thoughts of, oh, they're looking at me, they're laughing, they're smiling, they must know how inept I am. And teaching him some of those ways of debating those distortions, as well as combining that cognitive behavioral approach with some social skills training. Because he believed inside he was socially inept. So what was beneficial to him was, okay, what skills do you feel like you're lacking? What is it you think that a potential mate might notice and be distasteful? Because it is possible for us to develop skills if they are lacking. If it's meeting and greeting new people. If it's initiating a conversation or responding to a question on the spot. Those are skills we can teach. It is possible to learn new skills. So when you reframe it that way, again, that's empowering for our client. We can change some behaviors. We can try new things. And hey, if that doesn't work, we can try another new thing. It's possible to change it. Let's look at the third case here. A somewhat shy 15-year-old teenager finds it difficult to sleep in her own room for the last year since mom and dad suddenly separated. She wants to sleep every night with her mom in mom's room. She reports her heart racing, fear of the unknown, and believes bad things will happen. For example, someone will break into the house or some random unknown bad thing will happen. Though there's no history of abuse or trauma, she still maintains her fears. Also, she has difficulty sharing with her parents regarding her fear of the unknown. She has major challenges with sharing feelings and assertiveness. Though she's well-liked and popular with peers, does well academically, is very well-behaved, and is actively involved in sports. Every session she talks about fearing awkwardness since the parents separated. Though verbally she says she, quote, can tell her parents anything, unquote, she does not follow through on approaching them, even with minor things, or even positive things. So we decide to do this together in the counseling session. How would you diagnose her? What would your treatment plan include? So one of the things I think is really important as we read this case is the idea that we have ruled out history of abuse or trauma. So we want to make sure, are there actual triggers? Did something happen to her or someone else? Because remember with PTSD type stuff, it's possible perceived fears or observing or hearing about someone else's trauma as well can trigger. So it sounds like she has some skills. And that might be the thing that I highlight. With her, it's possible that she's just not paying attention to the skills she already has. She has friends. Sounds like she has a decent support network, at least with peers. But there's something I feel like we might be missing in terms of when she says, oh, I can talk to my parents about anything, but then doesn't want to. So I'm wondering, really, is she saying that because that's the right answer? Or is there maybe a block there? We might want to do some more investigating to see if there are shame-based messages, whether it's a misperception on her part that she believes her parents will be critical of her, or whether there are some real shaming types of things. I've had teenagers that have had really supportive parents who have been very positive, affirming, complimentary, but yet that child was hard on him or herself. And so they perceived things as shaming or critical or were self-critical. So that was more of the issue. So it may be good to kind of investigate that and look into that. We could do some work on identifying the thought errors and cognitions, the automatic thoughts. And social skill development, too. You know, she's involved in sports. She's well-behaved. She's popular. But if there are skills that she might need, those are things we can practice in session. Those are things we can develop. Let's look at case number 4. A middle-aged woman who is a bus driver is fearful of driving again. Some kids and parents shot at her bus. She also reports those kids rocking the bus when it stopped on the train tracks and chanting things about kill the F, blank, blank, blank. She has had parents of kids from the bad neighborhood she drops kids off in try to come on the bus with guns and start fights, even becoming defensive if their child has been corrected for inappropriate behavior. Her employer, the school district bus system, has refused to put her on a new route, though she's had an excellent driving record for 14 years. They say if she's not able to return to work and drive the same route with no anxiety, she will lose her job. The bus accident has also affected her husband and family. When she gets those serious panic attacks, she anticipates that they're going to come out anywhere she goes. The grocery store or any routine thing. How would you treat her? Well, one thing when I work with this lady is, first of all, I affirmed the skills that she had of 14 years of her good driving record for that school district she worked for. And I wanted to make sure and build her support systems. She did not feel particularly supported by the school bus administration. They didn't understand mental health, so one of the things we were able to do is her to sign release of consent for me to speak with some of the administrators just to provide some information about the nature of trauma-based mental health sort of things, that someone could have a perfect work record and something that is perceived as a trauma can throw that off. We talked about things that could, if said or done, make the trauma worse, and things that could help with her healing. So there was a lot of paperwork, a lot of support, that kind of thing, but a lot of triggers for her. We had to learn to celebrate even little victories. Even not just driving the bus, but driving her car, even on a weekend with her family, even if it wasn't in that area where the traumatic incident happened. We had to learn how to celebrate. Oh, I got through another traffic light. Oh, I'm at this next place. Some breathing and relaxation. We had to, for her, she was a woman that she would say she's a woman of faith. So she used the metaphor of Jesus or God driving through her, helping her to make it to the next step. So it wasn't just her mustering up her own strength when she felt weak trying to get through this. That helped. The other thing is we did a lot of psychoeducation and work with her husband and with the people she lived with. Because even her immediate family did not understand what happens when people go through trauma. Her husband, who was a rather rational gentleman, just thought, well, just think differently about it. You know, every day this isn't happening. It didn't happen for 14 years. Yeah, it happened one day, but just think differently. You know, why are you so panicked? So there was a lot of education that had to happen in order for her to truly feel supported. And grief that the job that she loved for 14 years suddenly changed and the shock of that. She also was empowered by the idea that she could have some decision making in terms of the narrative from here of if she wants to continue being a bus driver or if she wanted to look into another career, what that would look like. Let's look at the next case here. Case number 5. Though successful in her job and in daily life, an adult woman admits to, quote, constantly feeling worried about everything. It becomes clear that though she has survived and overcome several situations in life, she still feels nervous. She thinks constantly in terms of what ifs and hypothetical negative possibilities. She also tends to exhibit a lot of black and white absolute thinking about how things, quote, should be. Her perfectionism and high standards have helped her achieve well in many settings, though she lacks contentment and joy. She feels cognitively preoccupied with readying herself for the next things that could happen because she does not want to be caught off guard. How do you treat her? So to me, when I hear this, I hear generalized anxiety diagnosis. We're talking about potential real situations, whether they're actually happening or they could happen. A lot of what ifs. A lot of almost like realistic situations, but maybe taken to the extreme. Cognitive behavioral therapy might be useful for this woman to help her identify some of the red flags, the thinking errors, and then applying some of those cognitive debating skills. Helping also maybe look at the underlying assumption about if I don't worry enough, I won't be ready for these what ifs. I do tend to tell my clients, if you're going to hypothesize about what if in a negative sense, at least allow yourself to also daydream about the possibility that it's just as likely that something positive, pleasant, or neutral might happen. Another technique that could work is actually planning for the what if. Helping her see what skills she already has. What could she do? Let's look at this last case, case number 6 here now. An adult male has intrusive thoughts at random times which tell him things that are vastly inconsistent with his typical morals and beliefs. He finds these thoughts unpleasant and evasive and tries to fight against them, though they keep coming. Once the thoughts come, he spends great amounts of time trying to do certain things enough times to counteract the intrusive, negative, immoral thoughts. How would you diagnose and treat this man? Now keep in mind, the diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder focuses on the client's sense that the thoughts or the repetitive behaviors are things that, especially the thoughts, are intrusive, they're unwanted. This client is trying to push them out of awareness. So we're not talking about a client who's welcoming and saying, oh yeah, this stuff, I'm really thinking I'm actually going to do it. So for example, I've seen women with postpartum depression, anxiety, or some postpartum psychosis that have had some of these patterns where they would not really harm their child, but they actually just feel that and they're so concerned because the intensity is so strong. Or this gentleman that he worked for a church setting and a ministry and was having a lot of obsessive compulsive thoughts, and his wife would come in, she would vouch for the fact, and other people would vouch for the fact that he would never actually do the things he was worried about, but these intrusive thoughts would come to his mind and he would become disturbed. Well, what if I may be like this? Why is this coming in my mind? Why is it interrupting my thoughts? Then he would do things like cleansing or repetitively counting or other behaviors, compulsions, to try and undo this. So in terms of diagnosis, it definitely sounds like a pattern that would fit that OCD pattern. With that especially, I tend to consult it or make a referral to someone for possible medication. Of course, our scope of practice is not to give specifics about medication, but at least to maybe just share the diagnosis and the symptom pattern so that a doctor, psychiatrist can really look over that and see if that may help. Over time, we can create a behavioral plan about lessening or dealing with the compulsions in an effort to avoid things. And so basically, we focused a lot on trying to undo the compulsions because the idea of, oh, you'll never think that way again, obsessive thought will never come in your mind, would be very unrealistic. But to acknowledge the thoughts, to acknowledge them and then refocus himself on, okay, I have a choice. May not be the easiest choice, but I do have a choice about how I respond to them. What do I want to do? And there is a lot of literature that also shows that people with obsessive compulsive disorder tend to have a lot of shame-based and just family of origin schemas in a number of areas, as we talked about that earlier. So sometimes that's also useful to explore. So that might be something you go through with this gentleman. Well, thanks again for joining me for this seminar regarding anxious anticipation and possibility thinking. I wish you well in your work with clients and look forward to continuing to provide these CEUs and courses to you. The home study tests that are required, if this is being done as a home study, are on the website at www.rolpc.org. Again, that's the initials of the practice, www.rolpc.org. You'll want to complete the mandatory true-false home study, and that gets sent through the website to me. It is date and time stamped, so we have when you've completed it, and we will send you a printable certificate dated the day you've completed it. Thank you, and we wish you well in your clinical work.